Hi, my name's Pete Redden, and welcome to The Way I Taught It, next level aviation knowledge in microbursts. Today, we'll be interviewing Mr. Rich Stoll, a well-published, trusted agent of the aviation community with regards to aerobatics, emergency maneuver training, UPRT, and spins. Rich is the author of many books that you can find at richstoll.com. You can find out more about his history of flying, his history in aviation, and his many accomplishments throughout his career. Currently, he's published the 9 principles of light airplane flying, and those include optimal learning, risk management, fly the airplane, roll, yaw, and pitch, lines and circles, time and distance, action-reaction, stalled flight, energy management. And those are coupled into mindset, motion, and mechanics. Ladies and gentlemen, it was my honor to interview Mr. Rich Stoll. I hope you find this podcast enriching and applicable to your future aviation training. Okay, now I got the recording button going. Sorry about that.
Hey, okay. Not a problem.
So we'll start over again. Technical difficulties. I hit the red button to start recording and somehow it did not start recording. So bad on me.
Okay, yeah, so not a problem. So I did a rehearsal.
So this is the second start of the podcast. We're going to go back to thank you very much, Rich, for being on The Way I Taught It. Thank you for making time out of your day. Thank you so much for putting up with the technical difficulties to be here. And we're going to talk about 9 principles, UPRT, the current state of flight training. And most importantly, before we start, how's everything going in your part of the country? How's everything going in your part of the world?
Everything's going great. We're under low clouds and cold temperatures, so haven't been flying for about a week or so, which gives us time to do some things like a podcast about aviation. So whether we're flying in aviation or thinking about aviation, we're always doing something in aviation, right? It's in the back of our minds somehow. Thank you so much for inviting me on the podcast. It's a pleasure to be here and hook up and talk with other folks in different parts of the countries who are basically seeing the same kind of issues. It doesn't matter whether we're sitting in Idaho or in Tennessee or elsewhere. A lot of us are seeing the same kind of recurring issues in aviation. And certainly you see that as in your role as an examiner, as a flight instructor and a provider of UPRT. So I don't think I'm going to be saying a whole lot new, certainly to you, and probably to a lot of the people who listen to your podcast, but it might be new to some of the other folks as well. So I'd like to start off
the 9 principles and how you have them laid out. And it definitely gets you thinking in a more organized way, better way to potentially present material as an instructor to a learner for them to understand how far into learning they need to go. And I'm really excited to jump in the 9 principles, and we're going to work with number 4 and 5.
Yeah, it's all good. So yeah, we're in the motion category, talking about 2 of the 3 that are in motion, which are roll, yaw, and pitch, and lines and circles. And so flying's a 3-dimensional activity, but we come to it from a 2-dimensional experience mostly. And unfortunately, we tend to teach it as a 2-dimensional thing, right? Mostly, pretty much everything's about straight and level. We might do some other things that will get us from straight and level in one place to straight and level in another place, but it's pretty much a 2-dimensional thing. But once we venture outside of that, let's say through spin training or aerobatic training, UPRT training, or something that we didn't intend to be in, an undesired aircraft state, some kind of an aircraft upset, 2-dimensional thinking and acting is not going to work. And so as an example, suppose on whatever lesson that is, one of the early lessons with a primary student, you sit down and you say, look, we're gonna talk about roll, yaw, and pitch. Those are the 3 things that the airplane can do. And everything we do in the airplane is somehow, some way made up of those 3 ingredients, right? And of course, in normal flying, we try to cancel yaw as much as possible, but we're still doing a lot of rolling and pitching and things like that. Why don't we tell the trainee that we're gonna internalize it? We're gonna make those motions relative to you sitting in the cockpit. So it's less about relative to the horizon and more about relative to you. And so from day one, we say, look, when you're rolling the airplane or banking the airplane, it's going to look as if the nose of the airplane, or if you look out at the wingtip as you're rolling, it's moving from your head to your hip. And it doesn't matter how the airplane is oriented in space, it's a head-to-hip movement. That's how we see the roll, perceive the roll. From a pitch standpoint, it's not up or down. It may not always be up or down. Often it's not. What if we think in terms of if I pull back, it pitches toward your head. And if I push forward, it pitches toward your feet. We would see that over the nose. You can see that looking out at the wingtip as well. And then yaw is going to be an ear-to-ear movement. And interestingly enough, that's how I've been teaching it to the pilots who come to me, who are not primary students. They are wanting to learn more, expand their own envelopes. And so this is where we start. And that was 1987. Well, interestingly enough, if you read deeply enough, in the airplane flying handbook, you'll see that they've actually borrowed that language. It's in there now. So why don't we teach it that way, right? And so from day one, they're thinking relative to me, not the horizon. And then we add another layer to it is, okay, basic object motion. The airplane can only follow one of two flight paths. Doesn't matter where that is in space. You're either going on a straight line or in some kind of a circle or part of a circle. So we have roll, yaw, and pitch, conceptually pretty simple. There are only three basic maneuvers, only two basic flight paths. And then we can build from there. And then from a principal standpoint, when we start talking about turns around a point, a rectangular pattern, a chandelle, we can talk in these same terms because they've been seeing that all along. It's just now we might be doing it instead of a horizontal plane, it might be the vertical plane, it might be in the oblique somewhere, right? So again, nothing new. It's just, why don't we deconstruct these maneuvers into these basic pieces, make sure the pilot understands and can tell you the difference between these different pieces, and then we build it back up again. That goes to the mindset principle of optimal learning. That's how we learn the best. We see the whole, we break it down into the parts, and then we put it back together into the whole again. And if we start from kind of this basic example, when you ask a pilot, what makes the airplane turn? They won't necessarily go to the rote answer, which is horizontal component of lift, because it's not always that. It's much bigger than that. I said turn. I didn't say in the horizontal. I didn't say in the vertical, right? I didn't tell you where it was. I said turn. Well, turn is a way of describing a curved flight path. And if you think about one hop around the traffic pattern, you've got vertical turn pieces, you've got oblique turn pieces, you've got horizontal turn pieces, you've got straight lines. They're all there and they all have their own unique pieces to them, right? So if we get into stalled flight, we talk about accelerated stalls. Well, that can occur anytime we're curving the flight path. Could be in the oblique, could be in the horizontal, could be in the vertical.
When you talk about first principles, and I have my idea from my time in the United States Air Force, and I'll get into that in a second. But when you talk about first principles, where did you get that concept? Where did you get that, the thought and the inspiration for the first principles?
Yeah, so I've been instructing since 1987. I got my private pilot's license in 1984. And so it's only taking almost 40 years in aviation to think about or contemplate this idea of first principles. And it came about because a couple of years ago, I decided to stretch my own comfort zone and with new learning and become a student again, right? And we never really know how learning one thing in its context might apply to something else. And so I started taking Krav Maga training, which is Israeli self-defense martial art. And they're all principles-based. They talk about the basic principles from day one. And in some ways, they incorporate a lot of terminology we use in aviation and maybe even do a better job of it than we do in aviation, which is a little disturbing that we don't make as much use of it, like awareness and avoidance and color code and OODA loop. And so it really got me scratching my head and saying, you know, I've been flying all along, but I've never thought in those terms before. Why don't I invest some time? It took me about 3 months of thinking and probing. And again, as you mentioned up front, there's nothing new about them, but it's why don't we identify them? And it acts as an anchor as we move forward, but also brings us back. You know, can I connect things to these principles, and how would I do that?
We forget sometimes that powered flight has only been around for about 120 years, where a lot of these other skill-based, knowledge-based learning, like the martial arts, have been around for maybe thousands of years. They've honed their crafts, if you will. I think we're in the process, or at least in a period of where we're starting to see that we need to rehone the crafts And I think that's what the nine principles bring to the table is, hey, here's a wheel. Well, this one's made out of stone. We know what the wood one looks like. Let's make it out of rubber and see how that works out for us and what we can do with that. So I think it's going to accelerate us into the future of what I call the flight training industry, not necessarily general aviation, but just the industry, the flight training industry in general. Now, first principles for me, you know, I can go back to my days when I was learning how to fly, and my instructor would not let me do anything else until I learned how to trim the airplane. And he put me through very specific exercises to go, look, once you learn how to trim the airplane will fly itself. And now you can, that frees up other things for you. That was my first three lessons. And I think it worked really well. And it's something I've carried with me. And then I look at the first principles of what the Air Force taught me. And you talk about us in relationship to the horizon. Well, the Air Force talks about the pilot in relationship to the total lift vector in relationship to the horizon. And that's what you learn first as an individual pilot. And then they go, okay, now that you learn that, we're going to bring a second airplane into the mix. And now you have to learn your lift vector in relationship to you and the horizon and the other person and their airplane and their lift vector. And then we go one more step and we go, now we're going to introduce chaos and we're going to bring an adversary. And now you have to deal with their lift vector and your lift vector and your wingman's lift vector and the horizon and your position relative to it. I see those building blocks that maybe, and I know we're going to talk about the current state of flight training. We're both trying to fill that void. And I definitely see the building up to the higher levels of learning not occurring as efficiently as they once were in flight training when, you know, every flight instructor was either a World War II, Korean, Vietnam, or Gulf War veteran. It took a long time for someone to go from flight instructor check ride to the airlines. And now we're, instead of years, maybe even a decade, we're doing it in months. So I definitely see how the nine principles apply to me and my thought process and how I could take them and use them further on down the line. But again, it's almost like rewiring how not only how you learn, but how you teach.
Yeah, right. And again, it's taking what you already know, what you're already doing, and just, as you said, kind of recategorizing it. And you presented a great example there of your Air Force training experience where it was all three-dimensional based, right, as well, because that's the environment that we're operating in, Air Force or not, and then continuing to layer on complexity, right? Add the wingman, but yet the wingman is the same concepts, the same principles. Mm-hmm. Add the adversary, same principles, right? You're just viewing them in different contexts, different perspectives. And so from that standpoint, yeah, we can kind of see that it's always been there. And you're right. Over the decades, there's a tremendous amount of institutional knowledge that we have lost. As well, as you mentioned, aviation has evolved to a point where it sort of treats itself as if it's different from all the other learning environments, right? When mm-hmm. it really isn't, not at all. Right. And in fact, my latest blog post talks about that a little bit. It talks about the Wright brothers, right? I mean, when they established their first flight school, guess what they did? They had an academic component, the ground school. They had simulation. They wired up, hooked up a flyer in the corner of a hangar with an electric motor to simulate, to actually wing warp so pilots could simulate. They were using simulation. And then you got in the airplane, right? So they had a learn, do, fly or an academic simulation in airplane from day one, from 1910. And then by 1944, when Wolfgang Langevici wrote his Stick and Rudder, that was gone. It had evolved to basically teaching about building an airplane instead of flying an airplane. And we got away from that. At the same time, if you look at how sports and sports psychology and all of that has evolved, athletes today are better younger than they were 100 years ago. And so the question I pose in the blog post is, are we seeing better stick and rudder skills earlier in flight training than we did 40, 50 years ago? And I would hypothesize, and this is backed up by a lot of other pilots I know, we'll get your experience as well, is that they're worse. And in fact, they are worse later as well.
Right. And we talk about the skills. There is certainly, from the way I flew, and I was taught right off the bat, the VFR turn is done at 30 degrees of bank. There is no other bank angle until you start getting the ground reference maneuvers and you start learning about ground speed, and then you vary your bank. And what we're starting to see just in the last 12 months is on VFR check rides, private pilot, commercial pilot, we may not see over 15 degrees of bank on a just a random turn in space. We're not talking about a maneuver or anything. I will ask the applicants, I'm like, so why a 15 degree bank turn? Why not a 30 degree bank turn? Because I'm making sure my bias is not missing something. And they just, because that's what my instructor did. And then I have to go back to the flight school and go, why a 15 degree bank turn? Because that's what my instructor taught me. And somewhere along the way, I don't want to necessarily say fear a bank angle of 30 degrees, but we just don't use it. And that was something that was standard for me. And I teach my students 30 degree bank turn VFR. That's what you're going to use later on when we start looking at steep turns or steep spirals or anything that requires a bank angle over 30 degrees. All of a sudden we become very hesitant once we pass that magical 30 degree angle, where in my flight training, it was just, we do it and we do it coordinated and we don't worry about anything because we understand how we got to this point. I start seeing that happening. I start seeing the lack of not just right rudder, right? Because we're flight instructors and that's our favorite phrase, more right rudder, but just lack of rudder. I mean, feet almost flat on the floor. And that's kind of the way the Air Force teaches you later after primary training, because we have rudder boosts, we have yaw dampeners, we have a lot of computers that make all that happen. So if you're pushing the rudders, you're actually hurting yourself. You're not helping yourself. But in general aviation and in the flight training industry, those are critical. And I ask, you know, do you understand coordination? You go through those exam questions and they understand everything about it. And they'll push it for the first 15 seconds on climb out, if that's what the case may be. And then all of a sudden it just slowly, slowly, slowly disappears and we're flying sideways. And it's kind of like, why are we not following through on that? The trim is another one. I was taught you fly the airplane with the yoke and the throttle. Once you have to stabilize, you trim. And then the airplane stays where it is. Well, now we've seen a transition. And I think more to what you're saying is, I see people trying to fly the airplane with the trim and they're never really moving. The only time the yoke moves is when they're moving the trim in their other hand. And that's when the yoke moves in their left hand. So we've moved away from those, I think, principles that we carried for the first 100 years of flight training. And then the last 20 or so, they've kind of devolved as the entire industry has accelerated, moving pilots through the pipeline.
Yeah. And I think the context is so important. And again, as you're saying, we're trying to move pilots through the pipeline. And this has been a slowly devolving situation for a long time. You're absolutely right. We've kind of fallen out of calibration to the point where we're only at the rote level, some minimal understanding. There's no application beyond that, and certainly a lack of correlation, which Aviation Instructor's Handbook says we are supposed to train our pilots not to the test, but to be able to solve problems. We're training not pilots, but problem solvers. And of course, there's a lot that goes into that. And we should be doing authentic assessments, having them solve problems. And how do they do that, right? And
do you think we've lost our curiosity in aviation from the student or learner mindset?
I don't know that we've lost the curiosity, because I think a lot of the people who come in, student pilots, are genuinely enthusiastic about it and curious about it. And because we've allowed, as you talked about, right, the instructors, right? So an analogy I'll use is take a sheet of paper, print it out, and then make a copy of that, and then make a copy of the copy, and a copy of the copy of the copy. And pretty soon, that becomes a blank sheet of paper again. Instructors have learned from instructors who have learned, right? And so there's been a steady loss without understanding why they're doing certain things, comfort level of the instructors has gone way down. The stall spin competency is not where the endorsements say they are. And so as a result, right, so AOPA did their pilot training survey. And what did they find? 70 to 80% of student pilots drop out. The reason? Poor quality of the instruction. They started with great intention, even with the expense, even with the mountains of books and regulations and stuff they have to learn. They came to us and we drove them away because of poor quality instruction. Part of that is, of course, the way flight instruction has been designed as a bullpen to go somewhere else, right? And there's nothing wrong with a time builder who is also a teacher, but there's a lot wrong with a time builder. And that's all they care about because they lack humility because it's about them and it's not about the person they're working with. And so we see that. We see that, as you know, nearly half of private pilot applicants are failing their initial check rides. Why is that? Poor quality of the instruction. I've done some surveys over the years with almost 900 pilots with different webinars and seminars. One in four pilots surveyed believe the rudder turns the airplane. Why is that? Poor instruction. 68% of pilots in a survey I did with an FAA webinar failed to correlate an increase in angle of attack and G-load with curving of the flight path from wings level cruise flight. Why is that? Right? Of the fatal stall spins that you classify as instructional, 91% occurred with the flight instructor on board. Why is that? Right. Yeah. And of course, we don't even need to get into how big an issue in-flight loss of control is. So it all goes back to, begins and ends with the training industry itself. And we are not doing a good job. And we're seeing a lot of us around the country have been seeing this for a long time.
I think something that you're also hitting on is, I think the lifestyle has changed. When I became a pilot, when I was working through becoming a pilot, when I became a flight instructor, I saw the road ahead of me was a lifestyle that you eat, breathe, and sleep aviation every single day. It was kind of consuming. You applied it to everything you did in your day. You had the signs that said, we'll fly for food, and you were absolutely 100% serious. And there was this lifestyle of a pilot. And you had a certain path to go on. And now, and not better or worse, but I think the lifestyle has changed of a pilot where it's more transitory. Okay, during this time period today, I'm going to be a pilot, and then I'm going to go over here and do all this other stuff, which is fine and great, but it's not as immersive as I think it once was when my flight instructor was very demanding of me and saying, when you come for your next lesson, this is what I expect you to know. And if you didn't know it, you may not even go fly. And you expected that. The expectations were set. Where today, there's some metamorphosis that goes on where we're just going to teach everything in the airplane. Okay, not so much homework, not so much ground training. We're just going to go fly in the airplane. And I think we see that when I look at a logbook for somebody who comes for a private pilot certificate, and they have 60, 80, 100, 120 hours. And when I do the quick math, out of 120 hours, maybe 60 of that was just in the traffic pattern, doing landing after landing after landing after landing. And then you look back and you go, how much ground training did they receive? Okay, well, they might have received, 8, 10, 12, 14 hours of ground training. And it's a head scratcher because it's almost, we've gone from a predetermined, here's the knowledge, here's the evaluation, the teaching of the knowledge, the evaluation of the knowledge, and a predetermined outcome of what our goal is, to we're just going to go trial and error over and over and over again. And I think we both know, and we probably agree, that trial and error is the longest way to learn. It's also the most expensive way to learn, right? So, and I see that happening where the it's not so much a pilot lifestyle. It's more of, I have to get this training because I want a job in the industry.
Right. It definitely is a culture thing. And it may be partly those who are coming in are looking at that long-term goal, become an airline pilot. And that's perfectly fine. But the issue is, as you've pointed out, is they only make up, right? There are last count anywhere between 500 and 600,000 licensed pilots in the US. Only about 15% of them are airline pilots. What are we doing about the rest of us? Right.
Yeah.
And again, as a result, because we're not, we've lost this sense of community. We've lost this wonder, right? We're just going to pound the pattern, like you said, for 60 hours. What fun is that? I mean, how do we use, why don't we throw some other things in there? Maybe there are other things we can do to make that pattern more interesting, fun, and more useful learning, broader learning. And so again, because of the culture, you know, we don't hang out at the airports anymore for a lot of different reasons. When I was first learning, there was most of the little airports I went to, there was always a bench at midfield, and there were the old grizzled aviators sitting there and grousing about this, that, or the other thing, and talking about that landing or this landing. And if you hung around long enough and listened long enough, you'd pull out nuggets. You would learn things, right? So we miss a lot of that. It's next, next, next. And, you know, if the instructor is there just to time build, they're not time building in the classroom. They're doing it in the airplane. And so, sure. And we know that that's the lousiest classroom that there is. And again, I can go down the litany again of the results of all of that. 70 to 80% student pilots drop out. We're losing those potential long-term customers. And that's really the point. We should be cultivating long-term participants in aviation. And the culture right now, at least broadly speaking, there are pockets, but broadly speaking, isn't interested in that. And so how do we change that?
I think one of the things in the nine principles that you shared, and I think that's where I got it from, is you talked about autonomy, mastery, and purpose, right? And the ACS talks about mastery specifically. You have to be able to master all these tasks, knowledge, and decision-making capabilities. So it kind of indirectly infers autonomy. But purpose, I think that's a key piece of the puzzle here, because without purpose, why do we do what we do?
Yeah, exactly right. And so we need to cater and feed all of those. That's, again, I'm going to hypothesize that's why most pilots are coming to learn to fly, because in the end, 15% of them are airline pilots. What about the other 85%? And then if we look kind of beyond the issues with initial training, there's a lot of discussion about proficiency training or getting pilots on a recurrent training program. Well, if their initial training experience was so poor, but yet they persevered in spite of that, why on earth would they ever want to go back into that again, right? They'll fumble along, learn on their own, do their flight review. But unless the instructors, again, build a culture that ongoing education, ongoing training is normal and necessary, why would we expect pilots to engage in a proficiency program? Now, there are certainly those who participate in WINGS programs, those who will invest from around the country, around the world even, to come to places like Santa Paula, to come to Tennessee, to come to me in Idaho, because they want that. They see they need it. They're committed to it. For every one or two of those who makes kind of that big commitment, I say if the culture was better at the local home airports, you would see a lot more people participating in spin training, UPRT, aerobatic training, getting a glider rating, a float plane rating, building a proficiency program that's long term, because they've been invited in and invested in being a long term participant.
I think, you know, as we transition into the UPRT discussion, you talk about in your book, Mindset, Motion, and Mechanics. And I've always had an issue with safety, the word safety. And people just say, this is safe, that's not safe, and we're going to be safe today. I've always had a difficult issue with that, not because I don't want to be safe, but because no one's ever really defined it. And I think when you talk mindset, motion, and mechanics, you're starting to define what safety is. And the reason I bring that up, I got a coin here and it's got your name on it. It's going to come to you in the mail. But when I talk to people about UPRT and what we offer, It's safety through knowledge, application, and skill, mindset, motion, and mechanics, right?
Right.
So all of us kind of senior folks in the aviation industry, we're all starting to think around the same things of how do we boil this down? And an often ill quote from Einstein that's been butchered and paraphrased multiple times and then requoted, Einstein is somehow credited with saying, if you simply can't explain it, you simply don't understand it. That's something I challenge folks with when I teach them. And I say, they say, hey, we're going to go out there and we're going to be safe today. And I say, okay, well, how are we going to do that? What determines what safe is, right? And we have the ACS and we have stuff like that. But a lot of people, I think we've, like you said, we've diverged so far from what we knew, whether it's mindset, motion, mechanics, or knowledge, application, skill, we've forgotten how to tie those all together. And those nine principles kind of do that. And then we get into UPRT, which I think people are starting to see as top-off training. I don't think I got everything I needed as a private pilot, so I'm going to go do this spin upset recovery training and see what this is all about. And then they walk away and they every single time, I've probably done this 20 or 30 times now, they walk away and they go, how come I wasn't told that in private pilot?
That's exactly how I got into emergency maneuver training, which which I'm calling, you know, the original UPRT program since 1987. I learned to fly because I wanted to try aerobatics. As a teenager, I would go in Northwest New Jersey, it's where I grew up, go to the local air show, Sussex Air Show. And lo and behold, the star of the show, based there, Leo Laudenslager, right? And I didn't know anything from anything at that point. He attracted all these other performers who would come there. And I go, wow, you know, maybe one of these days, right? And I actually learned to fly because I wanted to try aerobatics. Pretty much as soon as I got my private, I sought aerobatic training out. And I have to say, I was pretty lucky throughout my training experience that good instructors found me somehow. Maybe it was a karma thing. I don't know, because I could have just as easily, that the norm would have been to have been discouraged out of the whole aviation thing to begin with, if you look at the numbers, right? And so I entered my first aerobatic contest at 120 hours total time in a decathlon, and I didn't come in last place, but it was the most amazing experience. And as part of that, it was like, wow, the elevator turns the airplane. Wow. Why wasn't it taught this way in the beginning? It's not hard to do. It's not adding things. It's just framing it in a way that is broad, right? And that you can see how it applies to all the different things. And then that opportunity came up to put together a program, revitalize an existing one, and make it less aerobatic and more UPRT. And I started teaching it and started seeing kind of the same things as you're seeing, right? People coming in, yeah, I don't understand this. I'm afraid of that. My training wasn't good. This is, in some cases, this is my last shot. If I can come out of this training feeling good, I'm going to stay in aviation. It could be, you know, the last stop for a lot of people. So that's kind of how I got my start in this whole side business, right?
You said a few things there. So first of all, I'm also a former Jersey kid, exit 10, Edison. So I knew there was something special about both of us, right? So great minds think alike. We're also all from New Jersey.
From the Turnpike.
Yeah, there you go. And then aerobatics, right? So now here I am. I'm on the other side of where you were. I'm a 6,000 hour pilot, and I have all this stuff behind me in this history. And I'm just thinking about going to my first aerobatic competition this summer. So not that because I hadn't thought about it before, but I think just timing is right now for where I am. But I think that what we're talking about is, you know, I fly my Citabria. It's 115 horsepower airplane, high wing, tail wheel, no real instruments in it except what's required. And, you know, I have a ball in it, and I have a lot of clientele, and they have all the high-tech airplanes. And I go and I fly with them, and we review things and we learn things and we teach them how to fly better. And they're safer because they know the definition of safety and they understand what it takes. It takes three parts. And they use their airplanes for business and as a tool. But they always ask the same question. They say, Pete, why do you have a Citabria? Why do you have a wooden fabric airplane that's not IFR capable? It doesn't have an autopilot, doesn't have much of anything. And that's a pretty good Garmin stack in there, but it's truly off to the side. And it's because I tell them all the time, I go, because that airplane forces you to fly. It forces you to be a pilot the entire time. You can't just flip a switch or push a button. You have to put the flight controls in the proper position before the airplane gets out of whack. And that's where my challenge is, to not become complacent. Because I've flown all the autopilots, I've flown the high-tech stuff, and I can do that real well. To me, I will make more mistakes in that environment than I will one where I have to have my hands on the stick and the throttle the entire time. So that's kind of the way I look at that and draw back to them. And then the aerobatics is the same way. That's that next level of challenge. Yeah, when I go up in a traffic pattern, I'm not really sweating. I'm not really breathing heavy unless I'm doing a lot of instruction. But you put me in an aerobatic airplane and you challenge me with not only just the maneuvers and the three-dimensional thought process for, if you consider, you know, time, but what about all the extraneous stuff? You know, I got to get my parachute repacked. I have to have all my inspections done on my airplane. There's a whole bunch more layers, all that to do that safely. So So aerobatics is what keeps me on my toes, for sure. And I think a lot of advanced and experienced pilots are probably using it at that. One of the other things I see in UPRT all the time is when I teach, I say, you know, a spin is a stable aerodynamic event at 1G. And people are like, no, it's complete chaos and the airplane's out of control. It's like, nope, it's a 100% stable aerodynamic event at 1G that you should really have no fear about, except the fear of the unknown and or it occurring in the wrong airplane. And when people realize that, and you take them up and you take the time to show them that this is a stabilized maneuver, and if you look up from the spinning disc in front of you, that point that's spinning really fast, and you look out, you go, I'm not really spinning that fast when you look towards the horizon. So how do you see UPRT when it comes to, we talked about the aerobatic piece, how to get into UPRT, emergency maneuvers training. That's how I got into UPRT. I read your book because somebody gave that to me. So thank you. And it inspired me to think more about bringing my Air Force experience in. But where do you see UPRT, the future, if you will, or emergency maneuvers training? Because they kind of are one and the same, but I think emergency maneuvers training is a little bit more bullseye oriented on what a pilot really needs to know.
It all came about, and they are one and the same. It's just a matter of degree, right? So the classic, I think the standard UPRT today, they talk about high angle of attack flight and the spin part of it, and then you have the rolling upset. We went another layer beyond that with emergency maneuver training, and we also talk about alternate means of controlling the airplane, you know, a stuck aileron, stuck rudder, jammed elevator, floating elevator. In fact, one of the things we'll do with pilots, it's toward the end of the first two modules of the program, is they will fly the Citabria Decathlon, typically what we're using, switching back and forth between those. They'll fly all the way back from the practice area, upwind over the city, and they'll fly an entire pattern just like everybody else without ever touching the stick. They're going to use their feet, they're going to use the throttle, they're going to use the trim, and they will land the airplane without touching the stick. Now, obviously, in that case, they're down two out of three primary controls, right? But how do you simulate a floating elevator if they're also holding and can move the aileron? So they're actually down two out of three, but that's what we're simulating. And they are absolutely amazed that typically, oddly enough, the landings aren't any worse than if they were touching the stick, which is goes to that whole thing. The airplane knows what to do. All we have to do is guide it, right? If we relax enough and everything else. And
I don't know how many times I've told people we don't land the airplane. We just put it in a position to land.
Right. And so emergency maneuver training, UPRT, is really fills the gap. It, as you see in the emergency maneuver training book, it was the gap filler between normal flying and aerobatic flying and training. So we take the best pieces of aerobatic flying and tailor it to the pilot who's going to go back into their 172 or their Cirrus, have an expanded experience with where the edges of the envelope really are, as opposed to where they trained it, which has been a very narrow slice. And again, they were trained not only in the narrow slice, but only to think about that slice and not anything outside of that. A case in point, you mentioned, you know, the trainees who come in and say, "Oh, the spin is a stable thing, and not this complete chaos, random chaos." Well, where did they learn that from? They learned that from a flight instructor who is supposed to be competent at teaching stalls and spins.
Yep.
So where did that come from, right? So there's a lot of that we're fighting and filling that gap. And then, of course, it's a natural extension. By the time you get to doing aerobatics, you've recovered from all the screw-ups. Now we learn how to do the aerobatics with precision, right? Mm-hmm. And so you build that comfort level, whether you go on to the aerobatics or whether you go back to your normal envelope where 30 degrees of bank isn't so bad anymore. And you're right. The amazing and wonderful thing about aviation is that we can do so many different things. If you want to be state-of-the-art, fly in the system, IFR, you can do that.
Yeah.
You want to fly floats and splash on the lakes in Montana? You can do that. You want to fly a Stearman? How cool is that? On grass? Even cooler. But what's the common thread? Roll yaw pitch? Lines and circles, stalled flight, energy management, right? And we might have more automation, more tools at our disposal in a higher complexity airplane. But what happens when those tools go away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And so the first thing in, even the FAA has caught on to this, they've put some templates in there, and I and a few others had some influence over the UPRT chapter that suddenly mysteriously appeared in later versions of the airplane flying handbook, but they have the templates in there. And if you look at the templates, right, at least in light airplane flying, unless the manufacturer says otherwise, what's the first action in an upset or a stall spin departure? Automation off. Yep. In other words, it's up to your stick and rudder skills now. So if we have a good basis in stick and rudder skills, then the other things are additional tools, not crutches. And we should never be throwing tools out of our toolbox. We should be adding tools to the toolbox. And so I think having that basis, like you said, with the fundamentals, flying a tailwheel airplane, things like that, where you really have to manage so many different things. When you get into an airplane that doesn't require that, you're less involved with it, perhaps. But if it starts to deviate, you know what to do to fix it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's always there. And we do need to take opportunities even in complex airplanes. Usually if I get in a complex airplane with somebody with all these big TV screens, because I'm like you, need a ball. In fact, in the back seat, I can't see anything anyway. So it's sight, sound, feel, right? It's 100% sight, sound, feel. And on landing, it's nothing about forward vision. It's all peripheral vision developing that sense, right? So when I get in those airplanes that have the big glass panels and we're going to be doing stick and rudder VFR, you know, sight, sound, feel exercise, say, how do you make that screen black?
Right.
Turn it down. Yeah. So, and I want you looking out here. If you need, you look at your backup altimeter and airspeed, but make that screen dark.
That's right. Yeah. It's funny. You brought up two things with the aerobatic flight and UPRT. And part of my brief is we're not here to learn aerobatics. We're here to use aerobatics to learn how to recover from some unique situations that you may find yourself in. And the one thing I do is I keep a record of all the G that we pull. And at the end of the flights, I'll ask the person, how many G's did you think you pulled today? Because they're not really paying attention to that. Oh, it must have been 3.5, 4, 5 G's. And I go, no, 2.5. That's the biggest, that's the most we pulled. And guess what? In your airplane, you can pull 2.5 G's and not hurt it.
Yep.
So you've done
we can
exactly
do everything within normal category design limits. And
that's
that's the
right.
point,
That's right.
right? It doesn't do them any good to learn how to pull six because you're gonna pull your wings off
That's right.
in
And you don't,
non-aerobatic
and you're not
airplanes.
going to put yourself upside down, but man, if you found yourself upside down, you now know exactly what to do to get out of it. And you know that your airplane is capable to do it one time and then you have to get on the ground. Right. And that light bulb going off is incredibly, you know, to see that happen and they go, wow, I didn't realize that that's what that was. Or, hey, when you pull, and you've said this too, when you pull out of a dive, make it feel like a steep turn. And you can't rip the wings off the airplane. I think that's incredibly huge when we talk about that and the automation off, you know, that's a key piece of all this because it's all goes back to stick and rudder. So where do you see UPRT? Not that we're going to transition quickly into the current state of flight training, but where do you see UPRT in the future with regards to flight training?
Well, we already know that the airlines are doing it, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're doing the academic and the simulation part. They some of them are starting to look at the in-airplane component because you really need that. You need mm-hmm. that, the GQing, you need that actual stress level that, hey, this is kind of real now. So you need that piece of it to cement it all together. And so I see general aviation, right? Why aren't we talking in those terms and those concepts from day one, right? Why should the first exposure be when the pilot gets to the airline?
Right.
New terminology, different way of looking. Mm-hmm. We should be incorporating that in from the beginning. And it doesn't add time to what we're already doing. It's just phrasing what we're doing in that way, right? So stall spin awareness, right? Aside from getting in the airplane and doing it, we should be talking in those terms from day one. But I do surveys of pilots all the time, and it's all anecdotal, but most pilots never heard about or referred to by their instructors to AC 6167C stall and spin awareness training. Everything they're supposed to be getting is in there. Why aren't they getting it? Right? And it doesn't add anything to their training. It's just roll it in, incorporate it. Right. And so I see UPRT on the, when we started with all of this in the 80s, it was all about aerobatic training. And there were a couple of places that were thinking in terms of, it's not aerobatic training, it's different. We're not teaching them to do the maneuver precisely. We're doing all of the screw ups. And so in the 30, almost 35 years since, you can find all kinds of places that are advertising emergency training or UPRT training, and those concepts are there. So there are a lot more pockets available. Now, we can't say anything about the quality of that training, but it's there. So I think more and more flight schools will probably be incentivized, especially as the airlines do more and more of UPRT, to start incorporating that or partnering with people like you, like me, who are specializing in it, because it is just as specialized as instrument flying, right? You can't be willy-nilly, you can't be cavalier about it. If you're going to teach instrument toward the instrument rating, you have to be a CFII, you have to have a special additional thing. Kind of the same thing with us. I mean, you need to have specialized instructors, specialized knowledge, specialized experience, specialized equipment to deliver it. And so I think there will probably be more opportunities to collaborate with schools, to partner with like what you're doing and things like that. We've been providing emergency maneuver training as recurrent required training for government pilots since the mid-90s. Fish and Wildlife, Park Service, Border Patrol, state troopers, right, who are get to fly cool stuff.
For 2 years with the flight school I was with, we were providing it for the Federal Bureau of Investigation pilots because they did a lot of straight and level, a lot of 15 degree bank turn flying. And once a year, they wanted their pilots to experience something other than that because they were concerned that if something other than straight and level, 15 degrees of bank, instrument flying or orbiting occurred, that they may or may not have the, that skill set to handle it. And that was great. And I like what you said about there's a lot of these nodes. There's a lot of these groups. You know, I almost want to say like diasporas, right? They're not networked yet, right? There's those of us around the community that we're in our own little pocket. And I have a little pocket in West Tennessee, and you have a pocket out in your location. And getting that network together, and then getting, you know, maybe the airlines to work with the flight schools to provide the resources, because the bottom line, I'd like to figure out, okay, how many people started pilot training 2017 each year, how many of those people that started ended up are now in the airlines, and what percentage of that is it? 50%, 60, 80%? Because I think the airlines can look at this and go, these are future employees. And if we can teach them in a Satabria or a Decathlon for a couple hundred bucks an hour, that's way cheaper than in a 737 that we have to carve out of our fleet that's in the middle of the desert somewhere to do this stuff once they go through the academic and the sim, and now they're starting to work into the in-airplane stuff. There's an economy of force there that I think as the aviation industry, we have to look at and go, you know, does this get levied on each individual person, or is this something that the community should look at large to provide the resources for? And not saying the FAA or the government, I'm just saying everybody but them to go, you know, this is something important and we need to make sure it's rolled into each piece of training that you accomplish. Because I feel it's very important, and I didn't realize it because in Air Force, we're pretty well-trained and we're pretty densely trained in that environment. But when I stepped across the line and started doing UPRT, I didn't realize how real the panic pull was. You put somebody upside down in an airplane and their entire life, if they're upside down in an airplane or if they're in an airplane, when they pull, the nose goes up. And when you put them upside down for the first time and that nose covers the horizon and they pull because they want the airplane to go up, and you ask them, why did you do that? Well, because I wanted the nose to go up. Yeah, but don't you realize that the nose is going to go down in this scenario, right? And I think that goes back to your, hey, stick forward toes, stick back towards the, you know, cranium. And I think that is really missing when all we do is, the only time we do a 45 degree bank turn is when the ACS forces us to. And I'm trying to make folks realize in my instruction, when I teach my students or in debriefs, hey, a turnaround of point is something that happens in the traffic pattern when you have to do a 360 on downwind. That's why we teach that. A steep turn, oh, you didn't do the 360, you didn't do the steep turn in time, and now the traffic is a conflict, even more so, and now you got to use a steep turn to get out of the way. You know, we do these things not because they're a haze or because it's just some random skill we picked out of that. There's a purpose for these skills that we have chosen that you need to have and test well on. And I think, again, we've forgotten that. I got to do a steep turn because I need it to pass the test. I got to do a stall because I need it to pass a test. And we don't understand the purpose behind each of those maneuvers. So we got UPRT, we got into the current state of flight training and rolling that in. Do you think we're in the current state of flight training? Are we in a sunset, or are we about to dawn into a new day?
I would hope. Well, I won't use a sunrise or sunset analogy. Uh-huh. I'll go to the treading water.
Okay.
Maybe we're not necessarily sinking, right? If enough of us, like you say, it's got to be a kind of a grassroots educational thing, you know, working in our own neighborhoods, but also communicating with others outside of our neighborhoods who are doing similar sorts of things. A couple of different parts to this, right? So on one end, it's about getting people to correlation, so they understand that pull isn't always up. And you can do that from day one very simply, which takes us to day one. The law of primacy. If we're not teaching it right from the beginning, So, okay, so now a 1500 hour pilot who doesn't have the solid understanding and background and has maybe they're not bad habits, but they're untested habits. They haven't been put upside down. Now they're at their airlines. Okay, they can learn in the sim and everything else and the academics, maybe get some in airplane, but they're going to have the law of primacy to fight the rest of their flying career unnecessarily. So we got to get them to correlation, but it starts understanding the law of primacy and that we've got to do it correctly from the beginning. And it's not hard to do it correctly from the beginning if the instructor has the background knowledge themselves, right? And that's everything that happens in between goes back to primacy, goes back to principles, but is moving forward to correlation. So I would say, I know I can retire from what I'm doing when I give a seminar, and nobody ever asks the question again, how does an airplane fly upside down?
Right.
That
right.
would be correlation, mm-hmm. wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
I usually answer it by, well, how does it know it's upside down? But that, you know, and then we start to get into the discussion. But if we have that broad understanding, principles-based, we wouldn't need to ask that question. We wouldn't need to come to someone like Pete in Tennessee and say, I'm terrified of spins because my instructor said this or that, and it's total chaos. Well, most of the chaos is in your mind. And so most of what we're doing is helping you learn to overcome your natural instincts, your startle, the caught breath, you know, catching your breath, breathing, and sort of flushing out the mythology, the bad information, or the misinformation, or the lack of information about this thing that we know about, we have experience right. with.
And I think you hit a key point there, and it's something that I teach in my grounds portion of the UPRT. This, when we do UPRT or when we do any kind of training, but I'll stick with the UPRT piece, it's an inoculation. We're giving you a little taste of something that you've never experienced before, so that if you ever see it again, you know what to do. And the inoculation has to do with stimulus and reaction, or stimulus and action. You know, if we go, here's the stimulus, and you immediately react, and you react wrong, well, that's panic. Okay, there's your inoculation on the first flight. On the second flight, if we give you the stimulation and you pause for a second, like you said, and you in the Air Force, we say wind your watch, catch your breath, take a moment to think about what's going on, because the airplane's not falling out of the sky. It doesn't know it's upside down. You're upside down. And you can take those 2 or 3 seconds to control your reaction and then go, if I pull in this situation, it's going to be bad. I got to roll first, or I have to push first and then roll, however we teach it. And now we've given you the inoculation and we've given you an opportunity to control your reaction as opposed to panic, and we get into the panic pull. And I get, again, that's, I think, the difference between a rote level and correlation and moving up the ladder is that we're trying to do everything from a rote memorized muscle memory thing.
Pass
the test. Versus, hey, if I spend an extra hour on the ground talking about all these maneuvers, I could probably trim off 5 or 10 hours off of that 60, 80, 100, 120 hour private pilot. And I think we've lost the edge on that ground training. I'll get on the soapbox if I start talking about ground training, but I think that's one of those pieces where people are surprised when they come for my UPRT and I go, it's 3 and 2. It's 3 hours of ground training, and it's 2 flights, not necessarily an hour each, because most people can't do an hour of aerobatics in that type of intense, highly dynamic atmosphere. And people are like, wow, that's more, you know, that's more than I got in private pilot. And it's just like, how is this possible? So anyway, I'll put my soapbox away. Rich, where do we go from here as the mid to senior states persons of aviation? Where do you see our responsibility falling to be better mentors for the younger generations coming up, and our passion to make them as great and as successful as they want to be by also providing them the right skills and knowledge?
Yeah. So first, thanks for being kind about the mid to senior that sort of thing.
Hey, I'm in there too, so I gotta be careful.
I tell people that the gray in the beard is because of all the spins. I don't know what the student's going to do, right? So that's where that comes from. I think it's just continuing to do what we do, right? In as many different ways, as many different venues and formats, podcasts and webinars and seminars and publications and hands-on stuff, but also building that network, right? Of people like us who are willing to share and collaborate, refer, and pick out those, find those people, they're out there. Find those passionate other folks who aren't doing what we're doing, but could. Find those few instructors, and sometimes they find us. I had a case of one, he was a CFI applicant, and he knew he wasn't getting what he needed. And so he just reached out to me, and I get text questions from him or phone call questions from him all the time. He said, yeah, yeah, I want this, I want that. And how do I do the next level? How do I become an EMT, a UPRT, a spin instructor? And we find those people because those are the easiest ones to convert. Then you have the ones on the fence. Then you have the ones that we're never going to touch.
Right.
So that's wasted effort. Find the ones who are eagerly looking and find them a mentor, hook them up with a mentor, right? And so I think that's where this community idea comes from, that, you know, we're not isolated. We're not on our own islands. We're seeing the same things. We're trying to fix the same thing. So how do we get together and have a plural impact as opposed to the singular impacts, you know, in our neighborhoods.
Right. Well, Rich, I think with that, we'll conclude the podcast. Any final thoughts, any closing remarks, anything that you wanted to hit on before we hit the pause button on record?
Yeah. Anyone who's listening, it sounds a little bit X-File-ish, but the information's out there. We're here. We're accessible. Reach out to us. We can refer you. There are materials. You don't have to accept the narrow envelopes or the discomfort that you might be feeling. It can be addressed.
Absolutely. I could not agree more with that sentiment. You just reach out. It may take us a day or two to get back to you. But man, we've had people, I always say, whenever I give a speech to veterans and Air Force military types, I always say, I stand on the shoulders of giants, and the people in the audience are those giants. And they poured into me, they poured into you, and now it's our turn to pour. And in this age of technology and information, I find it sometimes hard to find the empty vessel to pour into. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. We have to get out there, find the few, find the ones who are motivated to learn. And if you're motivated to learn and you're within the sound of our voice, we are here. We are ready to help you maintain your motivation and your eagerness and your passion about aviation and flying. So, Rich, I'm going to push the button to stop the recording, but it may take a few minutes for everything to upload. So don't hang up right away. I truly do appreciate your time. I am honored to have you on the podcast. I think my podcast is truly reached enough a next level when you agreed to be on it. So thank you so much. And yes, I'm standing shoulder to shoulder with you, but I've stood on your shoulders a little bit to become what I am today. So I appreciate all the information that you have put out into the world and into the community of aviation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pete. This has been a lot of fun.